for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Bill Gates Sr. admits there's a secret to raising a child like his only son, the Microsoft founder and billionaire philanthropist. The problem is he doesn't know what it is. In a new book, he talks about being the father of one of the world's wealthiest men and the lessons he's learned over a lifetime. The book is titled Showing Up for Life, and Bill Gates Sr. joins me in the studio. We'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. You can send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
I know that you are a very strong supporter of the estate tax. Talk about why.
Well, I see it as really one of the most sensible, natural, and workable taxes that are in the array of possibilities for, you know, the very important business of generating revenue for the American government. It's part of the general approach of taxation to impose a tax when transfers are made, buy, sell things. And the business of passing an estate along to heirs is a transfer. It's a time for a tax to be imposed. The beauty of it, it seems to me, is that there is really no great public benefit that derives from people inheriting large amounts of wealth.
When you say that, spell that out. Why do you feel that?
Well, I just am unable to see, and I would guess that most Americans would join me in this, that some children of a very wealthy family inheriting each, let's say, $50 million, I'm unable to see any value to society in that event. It seems to me that it's certainly fine to pass along to children something to make their life a bit easier, but to make them, you know, wealthy, totally wealthy, so that money, work, doing something is no part of their lives and no necessary part of their lives is not a positive thing at all. You know, there, as a matter of fact, there are among us some intelligent people who would argue that there should be no inheritance at all, that, you know, one's estate just should be confiscated. I don't happen to go that far. No, I wouldn't go for that far.
Yeah.
But it's illustrative of the values involved in assessing this.
Do you actually think that passing on, say, $50 million or $50 billion can actually be destructive to a young person?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that possibility is there. One of the really great things in life is not to have everything. One of the great things in life is to have to think and work in order to be comfortable.
And of course, as you and I speak, you are well aware that there are so many people without jobs right now who are struggling to make ends meet, who would, you know, just adore manna from heaven.
Sure.
If it were to come. How do you see the current economy and what's happening?
Well, it's not my area of expertise, let me be clear about that. But
you have opinions.
Well, you know, I was born at a time when we were going into the major depression of American history in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And I have a very, very vivid memory of those days.
What did your dad do?
My dad, we lived in a small town in the state of Washington, and he had a furniture store. He was a very hard worker. He made a comfortable living, and he was devoted to his work. It was he was really almost addicted to his business of running the store.
How was he affected by the Depression?
His business was diminished, of course. There were fewer people in town who were buying furniture, but he did manage to work through the early 30s and come out in good shape as the economy revived.
And how about your mom?
My mother was, as most women and mothers were in those days, she was a house mother. She stayed at home and took care of the house and cooked the meals, and that was what she did.
And how many of you were there?
I had a sister.
You had a sister.
Yes.
And what kind of schooling and background did you have? How did the family function?
The family functioned somewhat loosely. My father was, as I previously indicated, quite absorbed in the work of the store, and he was there on a six-day basis. My mother was quite an intelligent woman. She was a reader, and she, being more connected with my sister and I, was not one who imposed a lot of limitations. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a rather free atmosphere. People I associated with, things I did, were pretty much my choice.
Went to public schools.
What about
college?
I'm sorry?
What about college?
And I went to the University of Washington, which is a state university.
And
law school there, by the way.
And to law school there as well. Your parents were able to afford the amount of money to send you to a public, to a state-sponsored school.
Yes, the basic ingredient was the GI Bill. As I started college, as I got out of the Second World War, and the GI Bill was the major support I had, and they were able to supplement that so that I didn't have to work, for example.
Where did you serve in the Second World War?
I was in the United States Infantry, and I had the good fortune to be on my way across the Pacific Ocean when the war ended. Nobody ever shot at me in anger.
Bill Gates Sr., and we're talking about his life and his new book. It's titled Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime. And in this book, there really are a great many gifts that you have come up with that clearly have guided you in your life. For example, how did you meet your wife?
Well, I met my wife on the campus at the University of Washington. The intersection really was student politics. She was a candidate for secretary of the student body, and I was interested in student politics and paid a lot of attention to it. And we discussed her candidacy. I had a friend who was also in the race, who was my candidate.
A little divided loyalty
yes, that is correct. It turns out I voted for the other lady. But my wife won, incidentally, very handily. And as a consequence of that, we did things together, became friends, had dates.
Her name was Mary.
Her name was Mary, yes.
How long were the two of you married?
We were married until her death in 1994, so that would be...
long time.
Yes, it was 1952 when we were married and 1994 when she passed on. So
I
we're talking about 42 years of marriage.
After you graduated from college, what did you go on to do?
I practiced law. I went back to my hometown of Bremerton, practiced law there for a year or two. Mary and I decided that what we really wanted to do was to live in Seattle, where we had an awful lot of friends that had accumulated during the college days. And I had a sense that the practice of law might be a little more engaging in a larger place. So we moved to Seattle, and I practiced there for the rest of my business life.
And how long afterwards were your children born?
Well, let's see. We were married in 1952. Christy, our oldest daughter, was born in 1954. Our son, Bill, in 1955. And then our third child, Libby, was born in 1964. So over that period of time.
Bill Gates Sr., his new book is titled Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime, and we'll be offering you some of those gifts after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back. Bill Gates Sr. is with me. He's got a brand new book. It's a tiny little book. It's titled Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime. And we're going to open the phones in just a few moments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Your son, Bill Gates, has written the foreword to your book. It's a very brief one. It goes like this. He says, Dad, the next time somebody asks you if you're the real Bill Gates, I hope you say yes. I hope you tell them that you're all the things the other one strives to be. That's a lovely forward.
Yes, I think any father would give almost anything to have his son or daughter say something like that about him. It's very heartwarming.
You and your wife were kind of stunned when Bill Gates dropped out of college.
We were concerned. Stunned maybe would be fair. It was, our notion that we graduated from college and that our children would graduate from college. That's what you do, and that it's important to do. And unfortunately, in his case, business called. The software business was getting underway in Albuquerque, New Mexico. His colleague Paul Allen was there and needed Bill to come join him, so he actually dropped out of Harvard twice for one semester. Then he went back to school, and then after another semester, he dropped out again and went back to Albuquerque.
What did you think about his involvement in software at the time?
Well, of course, we didn't really understand it.
Some of us still don't.
Well, count me in. But we were very accepting, basically, of what he was doing. It seemed clear that he and Paul had thought through and understood, and obviously with great accuracy, the central importance of software in the world that was coming. And when it became clear that people would have computers in their homes and on their desks, it was clear that software was going to be a very significant commercial item. And, of course, they were right. Turned out to be a very, very good business.
I should say, did you understand as he got more and more involved, did your understanding grow?
It grew, not to the level of really understanding, but we followed when he went through language programs and then finally the operating system. We were knowledgeable about what he was doing.
Did you see this coming as he was growing up, little boy?
Oh, heavens, no. No.
What was he like?
He was very bright. He was a very good student. Perhaps the most prominent thing that was different was his just abiding insatiable curiosity about things.
And how they worked.
How life worked. He read insatiably and just was forever trying to find the answers to things that he didn't understand, which was, quite unique.
Your philosophy seems to have been rather straightforward. You write in your book a tiny chapter on hard work. You say, people often ask me why, at the age of 83, I rise every morning and drive to an office to work. I usually respond with a predictable three-word answer. I like working. Do you still like working?
I do indeed. I think it bears observing here that I do like working, and it would be whatever if I were still practicing law. I would still feel the same way. But there is a bonus in my situation that I'm working at a job which almost any human being would die to have.
Tell me about that job.
Well, it's a job. Managing affairs at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and we're involved in daunting, difficult, but the most marvelous goals in mind for what we're doing with the resources that we have.
Give me an idea, first of all, of those resources, and then give me an idea of how you go about doing your work.
Well, the foundation currently has a principal corpus of something just short of $30 billion, and we're spending close to $5 billion a year. That comes in part from the fact that we also have this funding from Warren Buffett,
indeed,
which he gave to us to enhance our work. So,
isn't he also about to give you another $30 billion?
That's our understanding.
Yeah.
That over time he intends his basic residue of his estate would come to the Gates Foundation.
Tell me how you go about thinking about.
Well, to start with, the stimulus for really making the foundation a huge foundation was the recognition of the egregious disparity in healthcare in the poor world and healthcare in the developed world. And it just made no sense that people by the millions were dying of things that people in our country had long since forgotten about. And that's really what stimulated Bill and Melinda to go as deeply into and with the generosity level that they have to make the foundation work. And, you know, it was it was kind of straightforward. It was a matter of us, you know, assessing what are the biggest problems, what are the things that are causing the most deaths, and for which there is some possibility of a cure, something to avoid these things happening. It was just sort of a matter of ranking the problems and then looking at, was there any realistic possibility of doing something about it? And then if so, let's go. And then the immediate consequence of that, of course, is the need to employ folks who understand the problems. And we, you know, the foundation has something over 700 employees now, and they're basically people who understand the work that we're doing. We have people, particularly in the global health area, who know about vaccines and about delivery of health services in poor countries. So.
How much of the work of the Gates Foundation is directed to countries abroad, and how much is focused on the United States?
Something over half of what we do every year is the global health activity. We recently commenced a new program called Global Development, and it will absorb, in opening days here, somewhere 20% or so of what we're doing. And the balance is programs in the United States.
And what kinds of programs in the United States?
By far, the bulk of that is devoted to attempting to bring about an improvement in public education in this country.
How do you make those decisions as to where those monies might go?
It became clear to us, as it is to a good many Americans, that the greatest risk to this country and its continued prosperity and leadership is the matter of public education, and that the condition of our public education is very, very poor. In, you know, international tests, giving children's competence in language and mathematics, we come out 22nd and 23rd.
Exactly. I was looking at some of those tables.
Yeah. 20 years ago, we had by far the most college graduates in the 25 to 35-year age group, and now we're 10th. I think that perhaps the most dramatic statement of this is the very careful study that was made some years ago and published under the heading Nation at Risk, which was a critique of our public education system. And in the introduction of that work, the author said that if we could identify that the people who have created our public education system intended the results we're getting, we should undertake to put them in jail for treason.
What do you think has gone wrong?
Well, the fundamental problem is that it's just that the quality of teaching has faded, and as a result of that, children are not attracted or induced to stay in school, and the product of the learning effort is not what it should be.
I note that you said the quality of teaching, not teachers. Is that one and the same?
It would be hard to distinguish them. No, teaching teachers say it either way.
Now, is that, do you believe, because they haven't been trained well, or are there restrictions or impositions on teachers these days?
I do not think that it's the fault of the teachers. I think it's the fault of the system. What we know is that among our college graduates, those with the poorest college performances are the people who are applying to be teachers. We're not getting the best of Americans to teach our children, and it's partly a problem that the compensation system does not allow anything to them for being good at what they do. There's no inducement to do anything.
A good teacher.
That's right. And we all know perfectly well there are in every school, there's some really inspired young woman who can't earn an extra $5, notwithstanding the fact that she's producing results which are really important.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to read another small portion from your book. This chapter is titled Open-Mindedness. And you start by saying, my first thoughts on the importance of open-mindedness come from observing the contrast between my mother's and father's way of thinking and the effect each had sometime on others. My mother was an open-minded person who didn't have a lot of fixed ideas about what my sister and I should do growing up. Dad, who was somewhat insecure about his lack of formal education, found comfort in living by a number of inviolable axioms. Axioms on such things as the importance of hard work made perfect sense, but some of his other axioms allowed me to see, early on, the sometimes unintended harm caused by closed-minded thinking. Give me an example of what you saw as closed-minded thinking on the part of your dad.
Well, one very vivid illustration of that is the fact that my sister, who was 7 years older than I, would not be permitted to learn to drive because women didn't need to learn to drive, and in no way would it be considered that she would go to college because women had no business going to college.
So,
and this was a very bright woman.
And of course, when you got your driver's license, then what happened?
Well, it's just wonderful, heartwarming story. My sister, who was then working as an assistant in a doctor's office with a modest pay, bought me a car, which she knew that my father would not have done. And it was a 1930 Ford Model A with a rumble seat. I remember it with great affection.
You know, I wondered when I came across that, how your mother reacted when your father said, you will not drive, to your sister. How did your mother react?
Well, you know, married people make adjustments even to difficult situations. Married people learn that there are some problems with one spouse that one does not get up in the morning to fix.
I like that.
You learn to live with one another, and
you do.
For little idiosyncrasies and major idiosyncrasies. Well, major idiosyncrasy, probably don't go together. But anyway, there was nothing to be done about it. So she didn't spend a lot of time expressing disagreement or trying to change it because there was
nothing
no way that was
going
to happen. That's right.
That's interesting. Did you feel somewhat uncomfortable with the fact that your father felt that way?
I did. I recognized that my sister should go to college and that it made me sad that she was not going to be able to.
She couldn't even go to college. He didn't think she should go to college.
That's right.
Sounds like my family. Bill Gates Sr., his new book is titled Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles, at annenbergspaceforphotography.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some of the key things about torture former Bush administration officials say they didn't know. We talk with New York Times reporter Scott Shane. And we talk with British lawyer Philippe Sands. His book, Torture Team, played a role in a Spanish court's decision to investigate allegations that six Bush administration officials provided the legal framework for torture. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Windsor, Connecticut. Good morning, Meg. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi. I heard Mr. Gates talk about the quality of teachers has faded. I don't think he realizes that the discipline in discipline is something that's never been discussed, neither by the administration or anyone else. Discipline is a major problem because in the cities all across America, my daughter is an excellent teacher, and she is frustrated and really disappointing that the teachers are frustrated and they find it difficult to do their jobs. We have good teachers, and so many of them leave the teaching profession because they don't want to have to deal with the problem of discipline, which is such a major problem. I hear my daughter come home and talk about this to me, but she still stays in because she's a teacher and she's dedicated to the teaching. And I think in Mr. Gates, and I'm not just pointing out with him, but it's what he sees, and I don't think it's really his fault. If they just spend 1 or 2 days in a city public school, they will understand. There are problems in the homes. You know, there's no interest in the parents and all the other things and parent affiliation.
All right, Meg, I think Mr. Gates can certainly respond to your point.
Well, I certainly share what you're saying, Meg. I have the feeling that, I know that there are teachers who, even in the most difficult settings, are able to manage good conduct in the classroom. Now, I'm sure there's a certain genius to being able to do that, but I also think that there are ingredients of the ability to manage a classroom which can be taught, and my sense is that that's not part of what people who are wanting to be teachers are learning. Now, I don't offer that as a way of saying that can be cured and wiped away. I accept your suggestion that this is significant and widespread kind of a problem. I do think that teaching, the process of becoming a teacher, could include improved ability to deal with that. And I think that a really significant thing is to have a classroom where there is so much interest in the learning part, that the teacher is so good at talking about the things that the children are learning and having them advance and giving them encouragement, that in that setting, I believe that the discipline problems are diminished. There isn't any doubt, though, Meg, that if we're going to get our public schools up at the level we want them, we've got to find a way to have the children who don't know how to act in the classroom setting. That has to be reformed.
Thanks for your call, Meg. Here's an email from Jeremy. He's in Dallas, Texas. He says, your son seems to share your belief about the estate tax, although he has chosen to give away his fortune prior to his death. Do you think philanthropy is an effective means for redistributing wealth?
Yes, I do think it is effective. The philosophy there is that giving the deduction in your estate tax computation to people who give all or parts of their estate to philanthropic work is based on there's no delineating what kind of just any philanthropy. And the beauty of that is that in the country of this size, we get this enormous spread of people's money because of the enormous spread in people's interest, as a result of which the thing of dying and having money and having a deduction for charitable work has led to the existence of symphony orchestras and libraries and the Red Cross, and it's quite a wonderful thing. Now, I will go on and say that I have this rather personal, and I would not have any ambition that it would become the rule, but if I were the rule maker, I would not permit a wealthy person to give 100% of his or her estate and avoid the estate tax completely. My view is that every well-to-do citizen should, on their death, leave at least some minimum amount in the support of their government.
Here's an email from Mark in Durham, North Carolina. Is your guest willing to say that it was wrong for the Kennedys to pass on such wealth to their children and grandchildren?
Yes, Diane's guest is willing to. It doesn't matter. The names don't matter. People should not inherit this gigantic wealth. And at the bare minimum, with gigantic wealth, there should be a gigantic invasion of the public interest. And at the, you know, you have a very intelligent discussion about what the rate should be, and that's going on over in the halls of Congress as
right
we
now.
Speak. Yes, right now.
All right, let's go to Brad, who's in South Bend, Indiana. Good morning to you, sir. Go right ahead.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Sure.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. I turned the radio on quite late, and I thought I was listening to a much younger man. And I discovered
Thank
that
you.
You're very welcome. And I would like to know, is there something in your genetic makeup or is there some kind of lifestyle choice you made that keeps you sounding so young and keeping your mind so sharp? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling, Brad. Nice comments.
Well, that's a very, very kind thing to say. I really don't know. I would be, if we had time on there, I could list the 15 problems I have from my left knee to my right thumb to my ears, which don't work. So goring old ain't for sissies, as the saying
That's
goes.
For sure. You but, are a tall man. You are how tall? 6'7"?
6'6". I was 6'7".
You were 6'7". But I must say you look to be in really quite good health.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, the business of mental acuity, if that's what we're talking about, I don't mean to be presumptuous here, but it, you know, I have a job that exercises my thinking and speaking. And also I'm still active enough that I think those particular abilities have been preserved pretty well.
I want to put forward another small chapter in your book, one I was particularly touched by. It's titled Honoring a Confidence.
Mm.
You say some of life's most enduring lessons can be among the most painful. When I was in college, a friend told me something in confidence that was very personal and important to him. He asked me not to say anything to anyone else about it, and I said I wouldn't. But the story was so enticing, I couldn't resist the temptation to tell it to someone else. And before long, my friend's confidence wasn't completely a secret anymore. The result was I lost my friend, and I learned an important lesson. A commitment doesn't have to be written down in a contract or prefaced with an I promise to bear weight. Even social promises must be kept. That was quite a lesson.
Yeah, and it's a widespread shortcoming of, well, human beings everywhere, as a matter of fact. And it's not a good thing. I think actually, in my own experience, and I suspect many who are listening would say that they can identify in their circle of friends people who are not trustworthy, who have no ability to restrain themselves. If they learn something juicy, they pass it along regardless. And those, you know, those people lose respect. And then we know some people like that. And I don't, there, it's sad, but true that it's not good conduct for a human being to act that way. So.
It's important to be able to trust people.
If you say you're going to do something, part of the lesson here is to be a little more judicious about what you say you're going to do. I mean, you should think a little about your commitments before you make them so that you know you're saying something you can live up to.
Did you lose your friend as a result?
No. That's a very, very good. I love that question. No. We got over it, but he was angry.
Hmm. Yeah, I can quite imagine that he was angry. Let's go now to Stephanie in Burney, Texas. Good morning, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I had a comment about, I was listening when you were talking about teacher training in colleges, and what I found, I'm a special ed teacher, is that so many times in your coursework that you take in college, the college professors, many of who have never even been in the classroom, are teaching theories to these teachers to prepare them for the classroom, but they have little or no knowledge about what it is to be in the classroom. And my other comment is that I work in special ed with autism and ED, and the thing that I find that's most important is the connection between the parents and the teachers. Parent, we only have them for 8 hours. If we can't connect with the parents and work together and the parents take responsibility, we can't see progress. That's my comment. And
all right. Thanks for calling. Mm-hmm.
That's very good. You know, I'm inclined to say, oh, man, you've hit it on the nail. And as a matter of fact, you know, they're part of the work to reform includes a thing called the early learning movement. And a central emphasis of that movement is getting to parents. So to have parents learn and understand what they're able to do with 1, 2, and 3-year-old children, just infants. Mm. And what we know today is that there's much learning ability at that level, and the encouragement, the training, the preaching to parents about how to be parents is a very, very important part of reforming our educational world.
Here's an email from Bill in Dallas, Texas. He says, how does the Gates Foundation ensure that the money they use for various initiatives in third world countries does not end up in the pockets of corrupt local officials, or to ensure that people working for the Gates Foundation are not targeted with an idea for ransom while working overseas?
I have no idea about the latter problem. I assume that there's some consideration has been given to that. It's an interesting question, because certainly we have lots of experience with people being kidnapped, and you know, there are prominent stories today, mostly involving news people, but and people from the UN have been the subjects
That's
of that
right.
kind of thing.
That's right.
And I just have to say, I'm not terribly sure what our work is on that. But I think the one thing that's important to say is that we don't have a huge number of people on the ground in the poor countries where we're working, and the activities that we finance are done by indigenous organizations of one kind or another.
But that goes to the first question. How do you make sure that money goes where you want it to go?
Well, the bottom line is that we're comfortable dealing with private organizations of that kind. And I think it's true that the record is very, very different in respect to the, you know, the charities in these poor countries are respectable, honest people, and they do an honest job.
You're talking about trust.
We do have trust. Now, I don't have the slightest doubt that some Gates dollars have been dealt with in a fraudulent way, but I think it's a very small number.
Who is your co-chair?
Well, I'm... why did you ask that?
I just wanted to know.
The fact of the matter is that there used to be a co-chair, and she graduated to other things. She now runs the Smithsonian Institute.
Yes, exactly.
But it just seemed convenient to describe me as a co-chair, so I continue to be the co-chair With no co-chair.
With no co-chair. Well, I want to certainly congratulate you on your co-chairing of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, even though you are clearly, at this point, the chair. I thank you for all the work that the foundation is doing, and I thank you for this tiny little book, Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime. I like it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Bill Gates Sr., co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.